Welcome everybody. I'm very happy and proud to welcome you this evening. My name is Irena Gross and I'm the director of executive direct. You don't hear? This one? No. Hello? And yes. Now?
No.
No, they are not here. We hear it, but the people from.
Is there a switch on the microphone?
I'm sure there is a switch. I'm sure there is a switch. Or we were. You see, it does seem. This one is for registration. Yeah? Hello? Now? Now it's okay. Okay. Good evening and welcome this evening. My name is Irena Grudzińska-Gross. I'm the director of the Institute for Human Sciences, and we are incredibly proud today to welcome the president, the 10th president of Boston University, Dr. Robert Brown, who is going to give the introduction of our main guest of today, the Commissioner Benita Ferrero-Waldner. And thank you very much, Dr. Brown.
Let's see if I talk into the correct mic. Can you hear me in the back room? Oh, great, great. It's not clear they're attending the same event. In fact, they may not be. First, let me say it's wonderful to be with you this evening as I move around Boston University learning about all of the things that are going on. It's just wonderful to sense the richness of the program. So I was very interested in being with you tonight to see the community interested in the activities of the Institute for Human Sciences. I am pleased to be asked this evening to welcome you to the dinner in honor of Ms. Benita Ferrero-Waldner, European Union Commissioner for External Relations. The Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University serves as a forum for new nonpartisan debate, research, and education in the matters of international, especially transatlantic relations. The Institute is especially interested in the intersection of international relations and culture in the role and image of the United States in Europe. The lectures, panel discussions, and conferences organized by the Institute introduce European insights and experiences to American debates and bring American perspectives to bear on European discussions. We are very pleased to host these important discussions at Boston University, and I'd like to thank the Institute Chairman Christoph Mikulski, who's sitting at the back table in the other room, professor of philosophy at Boston University and rector of the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna, and the executive director, Irina Grudzińska-Gross, who just introduced me, professor of modern foreign languages and literatures at BU. They have made the Boston University a place where European voices are heard regularly. We are privileged this evening to have as our invited speaker an outstanding European. Ms. Benita Ferrero-Waldner was very often the first woman and the first Austrian to break new paths and show new solutions. She studied law in Salzburg and worked for several years in the private sector in Germany. She entered the Austrian Foreign Service in 1984 and held posts in Madrid, Dakar, and Paris before being named Deputy Chief of Protocol in the Austrian Ministry for Foreign Affairs in 1993. In 1994, she became Chief of Protocol for the United Nations in the Executive Office, and in May 1995, she became the first female State Secretary in the Federal Ministry for Foreign Affairs. In 2000, she became the first female Federal Minister for Foreign Affairs for the Republic of Austria, a position she held until October 2004. In July 2004, Ms. Ferrero-Waldner was nominated as Austria's European Commissioner. She took office on November 22nd of that year. Today, she heads the Commission responsible for external relations and the European neighborhood policy. She has worked very hard to promote further consolidation of the European Union and its friendly relationships with countless countries. She's been a tireless advocate of human rights. In her many texts, and speeches have advocated this position. If she will permit me, I'd like to read a declaration she made while she was serving as Austria's foreign minister. The protection, she said, the protection and the advancement of human rights have always been a personal concern of mine, and I will advocate them actively at national as well as international levels. I believe that this is the very best way to prevent wars and conflicts, which violate the rights of man, displace people, and force them to leave their home country. It is extremely important to have people like Ms. Benita Ferraro-Waldner at the helm of the European Union, an institution that plays a necessarily important political, increasingly important political and strategic role on the world stage. The European Union, with its 25 member states, enjoys a permanent presence in over 120 countries and territories throughout the world and maintains strategic partnerships not only with the biggest international players, with dozens of countries on every continent. Through political dialogue and through aid, trade, and development policies, the EU has worked to promote the core values it shares with the United States: democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. This is why the words of Ms. Ferraro-Waldner and her activities are so important and influential today. Please join me in welcoming her to the pulpit. Thank you.
Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Do you hear me there? Do we hear me? Yes. Okay. So first of all, Mr. President, honorable professors from the universities, Professor Michalski, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, it is, I would say, really for me a great, great honor to address this important institute here. And let me say that I'm just coming from the plane. So please bear with me if sometimes I seem a little bit tired, although I'm not really at this moment. The adrenaline is coming up, so that's good. My central thesis tonight is that our world is changing irrevocably. And if the US and the EU want to protect our fundamental values, we indeed must work together. The Transatlantic Alliance must be strong enough to enable us to really achieve that. And let me structure my remarks around 4 points. The first, the current state of EU-US relations. Second, the EU's ability to act as a major international power. Third, which powers will dominate the 21st century. And fourth, the value and necessity of multilateral organizations, particularly a reformed UN. We are going to the UN tomorrow. I will stay here for 10 days, first for the Millennium Summit together with the president, but also, and then for the ministerial week. And it will be my 11th time at United Nations, especially for this ministerial week. So it will be interesting, of course. Let me start with the first, EU-US relations today. Watching the footing of Hurricane Katrina, and I would say the almost apocalyptic scenes from a flooded and virtually abandoned New Orleans, we Europeans were once again reminded of the depth of the ties that really unite us with the Americans. Beyond the natural shock and also the intense sympathy for any natural disaster, on this scale, we felt an additional, almost instinctive desire to help. So in response to the disaster, for the first time ever in the history of European civil protection coordination, all participating countries have offered assistance, all. Under the European Commission's supervision, because we have a special department there, help has been mobilized from across Europe. So for instance, meals and pumps from the UK, tents and first kits from France, or a crisis intervention team from my home country, Austria. It seems painfully inadequate given the enormous need, but the underlying message is also clear. We feel your suffering, and we are also here for you, just as Americans have been there for Europeans at very difficult moments of our history. Yesterday was, you will all remember, the fourth anniversary of 9/11. That tragedy has produced a moment of great solidarity across the Atlantic, embodied in Le Monde's headline, "Nous sommes tous Américains," we are all Americans. For me, that epitomizes EU-US relations. It is a special relationship. We feel for each other as citizens united by the same fundamental values. Our relations have had, we have to also say that, the ups and downs since 9/11. But I can confidently say that we are now on the upward path. And this is what both EU and US citizens want. A survey of transatlantic trends released last week by the German Marshall Fund found that 80% favor greater cooperation between EU and US. EU leaders share the US's, America's emphasis on combating terrorism, bolstering homeland security, and promoting democracy, the rule of law, and human rights. The declarations of the last EU-US summit demonstrate indeed how much we are working together on our common priorities, including, for instance, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, regional conflicts, just speak of the Middle East, or now also the reconstruction of Iraq, or I just come back from Afghanistan, where indeed also the Europeans have taken on now, after the Americans have, of course, had the first important intervention there. And the threat also posed, for instance, by non-state actors. Neither one of us can go it alone. And I think we both recognize that the challenges are too great for either of us to deal with that individually. As President Bush said at his inauguration, all that we speak and all that we seek to achieve in the world requires that America and Europe remain close partners. I agree. And as the international capabilities of the EU have grown, it is only natural that the EU-US agenda increasingly focuses on the world beyond our borders. Our approach may, of course, sometimes differ, but we are working together rather successfully around the world, in some countries turning those very differences to our mutual advantages. We are talking to each other more and more, sometimes formally, like our strategic dialogue on East Asia, or now, of course, at United Nations in the Troika format, sometimes informally, like our daily contacts over Ukraine, Lebanon, Gaza disengagement, Belarus, and others. Our views on many of today's most pressing issues are the same. For example, the need to encourage China to take its place in the established international rules-based order. We have discovered the benefits of, I would call it, complementarity in the broader Middle East, Iran, in Afghanistan, as I said, Georgia, Belarus, and elsewhere. Perhaps most importantly, we agree on the need to discuss issues with one another upfront, at the stage of policy formation, before taking action. The European Union is indeed the key partner for the US in achieving its triple goals of combating terrorism, promoting democracy, and also bolstering homeland security. Some people in Europe think the US is an unreformed unilateralist, only grudgingly reaching out to its partners. I disagree. That is certainly not my experience in working with Secretary Rice and other members of the Bush administration. And it does not reflect the close relationship between President Bush and President Barroso. We would not be cooperating so effectively today if the US were not fully committed today to working with us. That, ladies and gentlemen, brings me to my second point. The EU as a major international power. There are also those on this side of the Atlantic who are skeptical that Europe can be a useful partner for the United States, who believe the EU will never be anything other than an economic giant, but a political dwarf. This school of thought, which I hope is indeed dwindling in both influence and numbers, seems to view the EU's development beyond a common market as an unwelcome development, as if the EU should have stopped its political clock in the 1970s. And unfortunately, the confusion over what the no votes on the European Constitution in the Netherlands and France meant will only confirm their opinion. So let me take this opportunity to address the reality of EU foreign policy. First, we, the European Union, we are not in a crisis. It is true that the no votes were a great disappointment. The Constitutional Treaty includes many useful innovations to make the enlarged European Union work better and bring policies closer to our citizens. But our institutions continue to function without it. We have the Maastricht Treaty, we have the Amsterdam Treaty, we have the Nice Treaty. Although we have not gone further forward. So we have a status quo on which we can function very well, but we haven't gone further. However, coupled with June's lack of agreement on the EU future budget, it was right, I think, to decide on a period of reflection, creative reflection, to address the unease that was felt by some of our citizens about EU's future. I think the decision on the Constitution was more a decision about the context and not about the text of the Constitution. There is still overwhelmingly support for the EU, but our citizens now take for granted the most impressive achievements, most importantly, 60 years of peace on our continent. This is nothing new. This is no reason anymore for great enthusiasm. It's just normal. So we politicians, we must ensure that today's EU also tackles the current concerns of our citizens. And this is economy, jobs, quality of life, and security, just to mention the most important ones. To maintain our position as an economic giant, we must definitely increase our competitiveness through better, more efficient regulation, including through deregulation. And we have to focus more on education, research, and innovation. At the same time, we must maintain the core of the European way of life. Our member states will be meeting next month, indeed, under the British presidency, to discuss the sustainability also of the social model, and of course, to meet the challenges that I've just mentioned. This is, we think, the right answer to globalization. Not cutting ourselves off from the world. We need to be molding, shaping global trends. And we also have to influence the shape of the 21st century world order. Ladies and gentlemen, we are already a global actor. I know from my daily experience that when we talk, people do listen. We are the world's largest economic bloc and the biggest donor of development assistance. And we use our foreign policy tools, aid, trade, and economic agreements, to promote, indeed, human rights and good governance in every corner of the globe. And for those who say we are no military power, just to give you the number, more than 50,000 European soldiers are currently keeping the peace and promoting stability across the world. But it's also true, we need to do more to match our political clout to our economic power. And we know that both the EU citizens and our partners throughout the world demand we play a greater role internationally. So a large part of our reflection on the EU's future will focus on how we can do better and how we can do more. In the meantime, the European Union remains a committed international player. Take our involvement, for instance, in the peace process in Aceh or in Sri Lanka. We are in Aceh spearheading a 230-strong monitoring mission, which will be on the ground just 3 days from now. We brokered the August peace deal, putting an end to 30 years of bloody conflict. We supported President Ahtisaari. And together with 5 members of ASEAN, we will now also do the staffing and the funding of a mission to monitor the decommissioning of arms and relocation of police and military. Or, as I said, we are also engaged very strongly in Afghanistan, where we are providing significant financial assistance to next weekend's elections. I have an election observation mission there under the European parliamentarian Emma Bonino, and I was just out there to support this and also to go up to Kunduz, which is in the north of the country, where the German and the Austrian troops are on the PRT missions to see what they are doing, and I think they are doing a good job there. And we have sent the largest, as I said, the largest ever international election observation mission for Afghanistan. And we are playing, just to give you a few examples, an active role in Darfur, also in Iran, you know, in the negotiations that are very, very complicated, and in Gaza, where we, the European Union as a whole, are giving more than 500 million euros each year, and we, the Commission, are there doing more than half of it. So I could go on. My point is, whatever our internal difficulties, we are, ladies and gentlemen, believe it or not, still in business. And we will remain a committed and an engaged partner for the US and others as we work through our international challenges. Of course, public diplomacy is vitally important. Within the EU, it's clear that we have to do more to capture the public imagination in an age where the EU's original purpose, as I said, peace, has lost its immediacy. We must convince the public economic reform that it is necessary to maintain our standard of living. Enlargement brings us enormous economic and security benefits. And innovation in our social model is, of course, essential to avoid being outpaced by global competition. Public diplomacy is also important for the transatlantic relationship. The Transatlantic Trends Survey showed that EU and US publics view each other in the same way as a year ago. This is not good. In other words, the significant improvement in EU-US relations at official level is not yet reflected in public opinion. Both the EU and the US governments must do more to present our citizens with a new reality of our relationship, because public opinion matters. Ours cannot just be a relationship of elites, or we seriously undermine this very basis. And therefore, I thank you very much also for being able to speak here, because I think it's important that we also bring our message across, and then, of course, it's being transported also by the media, and also thank some famous journalists here. Let's publicize this success story, which reveals the true strengths of our relations, like having two of the most integrated economies on Earth. Our bilateral trade relationship is, as you know, the largest in the world. Every day, we trade more than 1 billion euros worth of immensely diverse goods and services. As many as 14 million workers in the EU and the US owe their job to our commercial ties, including more than 100,000 only here in Massachusetts. Yes, there's the occasional trade dispute, but they only account, if you look to the statistics, for 2% of our 2.5 trillion economic and trade relationship. And I speak of dollars. An unsung success of last June's EU-US summit was, for instance, and I'm sad about that it hasn't come across, neither with us in the European Union, nor here in the US, about the EU-US economic initiative designed to specially remove further obstacles to efficient operation of the transatlantic marketplace. But there is more to this debate than simply feeling good about our relationship. Let me come to my third point. Who will dominate the 21st century? Recently, a number of analysts, including at least two Americans, I speak of Rifkind and Reed, have suggested that the future belongs to Europe. They believe the EU is best placed to meet the challenges of the globalization in the 21st century. I realize it might be risky for a European to stand here in Boston, not far from the beginnings of the American Revolution, and suggest that the American century is drawing to a close. No. My thesis is that the world is changing to such an extent that we will need to draw on the strengths of both the EU and the US if we want to define the international order of the 21st century. We will only wield sufficient influence if we act together, and we must build a transatlantic alliance strong enough to do that. Today, the European Union and United States have unrivaled influence in terms of relative wealth and power. Power relationships in the 21st century may be very different. I don't only mean the emerging economic powers like China, India, and possibly others. There are new threats, energy security. Look at the current price of oil, global health risks, HIV, AIDS, malaria, and new pandemics like SARS or avian flu, for instance. Entrenched poverty, sub-Saharan Africa has been getting poorer than richer. And a lot of environmental problems, climate change, major natural disasters like the tsunamis and Hurricane Katrina, and the mix of fire and floods in Europe this summer. The world's demographics are also changing, and there are generational challenges to all of us. I just come back also from the EU-India summit, and there, of course, the Indian Prime Minister and the Trade Minister said very proudly, you know, we will be the biggest nation in, I think, 2030. So we have to think of that. Plus, the hard security threats of violent extremists, international terrorism, and international crime, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and trafficking people, drugs and arms, just to mention major issues. Another major topic which will dominate the 21st century, or at least a part of it, is relations between different cultures and civilizations. This encompasses not only the Islamic world and the West, but many other cultures and religions. I do not subscribe to Huntington's belief in an inevitable clash of civilizations, but nevertheless, we must improve understanding between different cultures. Last week, again, at this EU-India summit, this topic drew a lot of attention, as it will also at the UN summit this week. By the way, in India, there are many, many religions, and there, interesting enough, they live very well together. So great countries, by the way, with the biggest Muslim community, can also contribute a lot to that. Indonesia, India, not only the Middle East, and us together with people in the Middle East. So I want to pursue innovative ways of pursuing this discussion. As I said, in the Middle East, India, Indonesia, and especially through cooperation with media. I once tried to set that up as Austrian foreign minister. I've had many of these dialogues, and I wanted to get CNN on the one hand and Al Jazeera on the other. Unfortunately, it didn't work. They didn't want to come. They did not understand how important it would have been to speak openly about this question and try to get it across to many, many people. To summarize, the 21st century will confront us with an even more complex world than today's. I come back to the title of tonight's speech, Building a Transatlantic Alliance for the 21st Century. The US and the EU need to work together to create an international order that will protect our interests and principles of democracy and freedom. And to do that, we need to encourage other powers to work with us and sign up to that international order. And by the way, since I've been introduced on this one phrase, I always, since I know the concept, have been working on the concept of human security. This is freedom from want and freedom from fear. And this, of course, means also human rights education, ladies and gentlemen. I think this is crucial. As long as you start very, very small, then you really have a feeling what it means to be a dignified member of society. Let me just add this. Well, I'm coming to my fourth point, the value of multilateralism and a reformed United Nations. For that, we need what we in the EU refer to as effective multilateralism, a rules-based, inclusive international order. The European Union works through many multilateral organizations, including the WTO, whose Doha round will make a major contribution to development, and regional multilateral bodies, like, for instance, the OEC and many others. But the only truly universal multilateral institution is the United Nations. With its inclusive membership and also worldwide legitimacy, it remains the most important arena for advancing common solutions to our common problems. So I think it's the perfect starting point for building and also consolidating the kind of international order we will need to protect our way of life and our values. All the more so as the UN's values are our own. Let's remember, the US is the home of modern multilateralism, as the 60th anniversary of the UN Charter signature in San Francisco reminds us. I believe that both the EU and the US, perhaps especially in the wake of recent events, recognize the value of international solidarity and also compromise. And I do hope so, because as I hear, the text is not yet there, so we don't know yet whether the Millennium Summit might be a success or not. In return then for international legitimacy that confers. And there is an increasing recognition that multilateral action involving large parts of the international community is the only way forward if our goal is to find solutions that really work. And make no mistake, as the balance of power changes in the coming decades, we will need the support of others. Ladies and gentlemen, we are on the eve of this major UN summit that will start tomorrow, one of the biggest gatherings of world's leaders ever. I think 170 are coming. I cannot overstate the significance of this occasion, at which we will agree the first serious reform of the UN's 60-year history, hopefully. It embodies just the sort of grand bargain between North and South, rich and poor, that is necessary to establish a solid framework for international relations in the decades to come. Choosing development, security, and human rights as the focus of the debate reflected a new recognition of interdependence, of interlinkage. Without peace, there is no development. Without development, there is no peace. And without human rights, there is neither one nor the other. The two major issues, or another major issue, I would say, is management reform and management administration, which for obvious reasons have dominated the news headlines very recently. Now, given our desire, and I myself was once chief of protocol of Boutros-Ghali, so I know the system from inside, the desire to see the system function effectively, the EU would be the first to say that the UN needs an organizational refit to equip it for the challenges ahead. But above all, we are clear that the organization's original promise, anchoring international peace and security, promoting sustainable development, and defending human rights and human security, remains as valid as 60 years ago. The lengthy and difficult negotiations over the summit statement are hopefully drawing to a good close, hopefully. I hope the result will be ambitious, but also will be concrete. We think it must live up to expectations. We need a UN better equipped to deal with the complex challenges to development, peace and security and human rights. But the real work begins after the summit, as we translate the commitment into action. This is where the EU and the US can really make a difference if they want. Together, we do have a proud history as the driving force behind multilateralism. As the world's two richest, most democratic, and most powerful entities, it is even our duty to continue this leadership role. By pooling our diplomatic power and resources, we can lead the world in building a new international architecture. One of the major successes of the summit, apart from the development goals going ahead with the 0.5 and then later on 0.7%, will be the creation of the Peace Building Commission. This will plug the gap between post-conflict assistance and longer-term stabilization and development. Getting post-conflict states up and running is indeed a very complicated matter. Too often, there is not enough continuity between the different post-conflict activities and international aid. Peacekeepers funded by one party, demobilization by another, reconstruction and institution building by yet another. But given that half of all countries emerging from conflict relapse back into violence within 5 years, this is vital that we find a way of improving our performance. And this is why we both, EU and US, have fully engaged in the discussions for setting up this new body. The EU has a long-standing experience in providing this support for a wide spectrum of peace-building activities around the world. Think of the Balkans, ranging from demining and social rehabilitation initiatives in Ethiopia, to promoting the constitutional dialogue in Nepal, or now our peace initiatives in Sri Lanka, for instance. And we are ready and we fully are committed to actively contribute to this peace-building commission's work. Together with the US, we must work hard to ensure it can carry out its mandate really effectively. We also have to do more to protect human rights. Abuse of fundamental rights is one of the clear indicators for future conflict. So improving our ability to act in this field is not only a moral obligation, but also addresses our security concerns. The present Human Rights Commission is no longer fully up to the job, and reforming the UN's human rights architecture is therefore crucial. Together, again, EU and US must push for a system which takes rights seriously, because this is about people, this is about our people. The prisoner at risk of torture, the child forced into armed combat, the woman threatened by cruelty and abuse. We must also put human security to the fore, adopting a more modern concept of sovereignty where states are responsible for protecting their people, not just their borders. We want the summit to decide on a new principal human rights body, the Human Rights Council. The summit must make clear the UN's undivided commitment to human rights and to human security, as I said. Empowering women, helping states meet their international obligations, assisting human rights defenders and children in armed conflict, and sounding the alarm when violations occur. And we must also be more serious about development. Economic prosperity is not the preserve of a developed world. Eradicating poverty and promoting development are moral imperatives which the world's richest nations are bound to address. European Commission President Barroso recently compared, and I like this very much, the modern scourges of poverty, hunger, and disease to slavery 200 years ago. Slavery, he said, was then considered an inevitability, a natural part of the order of things. But that was wrong. Equally, it is wrong for us today to think of poverty as a fact of life. We can and we must fight against it. That is why reconfirming our commitment to the development goals and setting target dates for their achievements is so vital. It is mainly a question of mustering the necessary political will. The European Union is already the world's biggest donor, providing 55% of worldwide official development assistance between the Commission and the member states, worth $43 billion in 2004. In May this year, we committed ourselves to further and substantially increase this amount. By 2010, we will provide nearly an extra $26 billion. And by 2015, we will reach the recommended 0.7% of gross national income. There is a clear link between poverty and political instability. Failed states pose one of the biggest security risks of our day. Think of Afghanistan in the past. So in addressing the causes of conflict and misgovernment in developing countries, we are also acting to defeat terrorism. In tackling poverty, we also move a step closer to human security. But again, this cannot just be rhetoric. It requires developing countries to tackle corruption, reform justice systems, and build transparent, efficient institutions. Both developing countries and donor countries must make serious efforts to translate dollar and euro signs on paper into real and sustainable progress in our partners' countries in the South. If the US, the world's second biggest donor, were to join us in this commitment and follow the EU's lead on increasing ODA, the impact on poverty and security would certainly be tremendous. Ladies and gentlemen, only last week, the UN Secretary General pointed out that the American people, as he said, have always been the most generous in responding to disasters in other parts of the world. That generosity of spirit is quintessentially American, as is also the exercise of moral authority and world leadership at critical moments in world affairs. Even as the US is still reeling from the effects of Hurricane Katrina, I'm confident that it is capable of exerting that moral leadership again in the cause of a more just world order, one which also holds in trust the values that underpin both US and EU societies. The European Union will support the US in this quest. After all, as my 4 points have illustrated, we are natural partners in seeking to build a consensus around the values of democracy, human rights, prosperity, and security for all. The European Union will be an increasingly useful partner for the US as we strengthen our capacity to act internationally. The world is changing rapidly, and we must unite together. Will be easy. We will have our work cut out to build the international order we wish to see prevail in the 21st century. But acting together, drawing others in by working through United Nations, we think we have the best chance to succeed. Which is why our task today and in the months and years to come must be to build this transatlantic alliance stronger than ever. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm very proud that you gave this important speech here at our institute. And I'm very sorry that we don't have time to have a discussion because we need to now have a dinner and we may continue the conversations over the dinner at the table. And I hope we are going to have some other possibility of talking about this. And I'm really grateful that you came straight from the plane here and that you gave us this
thank you very much.
Occasion. Thank you. Thank you. Please.